does it right now. Deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
You bet. Anyway, Paul Rodel again, IVS Oral History Project. It's June 26th, and I'm sitting in the computer room study of Dick Lockwood, Richard Lockwood, and we've had a little snack to eat, and it's about quarter of nine here already. But he was in Vietnam in 1968 through 70. So much for the official stuff. Now we'll start chatting. And the first question to you, Dick, as well as to, I think, everybody that I've talked to, maybe not the folks in Hawaii when I was still just testing the oars, but is something that was not on the form, which was basically, how were you molded as a person to get you shunted toward an IVS? When were you born? Where were you born and raised? What were your parents like? All sorts of influences on you as a human being, so that by the time you're a young man looking to make a stab at the world, chose IVS. And I'll try as best I can not to interject so much. Okay.
Yeah. I was born August 18th, 1943,
mm-hmm.
which makes me, in another month and a half, 53 years old.
Wow.
I was born here in Newton, Massachusetts.
Oh, really? Okay. Because I knew you would have been Massachusetts,
yeah.
but I didn't know it was actually the same town.
And I went to elementary school, high school. My first involvement in social activism or civil protest was in high school when a group of us wanted to protest atmospheric testing of nuclear bomb by Khrushchev.
In high school?
Yeah.
Jesus.
And
radical.
we built a dummy of Khrushchev and we covered him with firecrackers and a torch. And we put a broom handle on his back with a rope. We went to Boston Common,
where
the revolution started with Paul Revere and the Minutemen. And we strung Khrushchev up on the limb of a tree. We made signs to protest atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons.
Uh-huh.
And we lit Khrushchev on fire and ran, because as soon as the firecrackers went off, the police were coming.
Oh no.
Yeah. And it was kind of both a recognition and an awareness of what was going on in the world, as well as a certain naivete on our part to do what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
This was the senior year in high school, so this was 1961.
Yeah.
And of course that was the year that Kennedy was going to be elected. And one of his campaign platforms was to try and set up a nuclear disarmament between Russia and the United States. So this kind of fit in with that.
I forgot that.
Yeah.
Right.
And I went off to college. I started at an engineering school in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania called Lehigh University.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a program called Operation Crossroads Africa. And in 1963, I went to Uganda, and I lived 2.5 months in the bush
mm-hmm.
at an Anglican hospital, building an outpatient clinic with Ugandans and Americans in a cooperative project. So that was my first experience out of the country, and it was in the bush in Uganda. I came back from Africa, no longer wanting to be an engineer, but not knowing really what I wanted to be. Took a year off and worked on dairy and poultry farms in Upper New York State, and transferred into Cornell.
How come you went and did that rather than backpacking Europe or something like that?
Well, first of all, I think to convince my parents to go to Africa in 1963 was a shock, was big enough shock.
That's That's a biggie, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they wanted me around closer to home.
Okay.
After that, rather than...
They didn't have enough of this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Then in 1964, in the summer, I got involved in the voter registration projects of Mississippi.
You went down?
I went down to Mississippi.
Wow.
And I worked in voter registration for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And then came back and registered at Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And
where were you in school, by the way? This was already in Cornell.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. I wasn't sure if I had crossed a wire.
And then, of course, in November of 63 was when Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah.
And I got involved in, I already had gotten bitten by the bug to travel, having gone to Uganda.
Oh, yeah.
And Cornell, through their program, was called CURW, Cornell United Religious Works, which was an ecumenical group of chaplains at the university, were involved in exploring Latin America in summer projects, both from a religious point of view, liberation theology, and economic development theories. And there was a project for Brazil for 65 in Recife, which was 1 year after the revolution in Brazil, but really wasn't a revolution. It was a move to a dictatorship rather than a revolution of freedom.
Yeah.
And I went to Brazil in 65 and worked in a parish that belonged to a bishop in Recife called Dom Elder Câmara, who was considered a communist by the Brazilians.
Yeah.
And we worked with Brazilians in building a schoolhouse in this area. We spoke terrible Portuguese, they spoke terrible English. The idea, the project was run by a sociologist and a chaplain from Cornell. We were given a questionnaire in English as to what we thought the reality in Brazil was and what we thought, what were our stereotypes about Brazilian activists. They were given the same questionnaire toward Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were given the same questionnaire after having interacted to see how close we came to each other's realities. At the end of the project, we traveled all around Brazil, and little did I know, but when I got lost in one city, I would be found by the woman who eventually became my wife in 1965.
Really?
And this was in the city of Salvador.
Uh-huh.
I came back to Cornell.
How did she find you?
Well, we were struggling. We were a group of Americans. We were struggling for directions. We were lost in the city.
Yeah.
She spoke fluent English. She said, you know, I'll help you. And introduced herself, and that was the start of a romance.
Yeah.
A long-distance romance. Because this is 1965.
Uh-huh.
I finished the summer project.
Yeah.
Went back to Ithaca.
Yeah.
Graduated in 66.
Uh-huh.
Stayed on for a master's at Cornell.
Okay.
And in nutrition. And in 68, I got drafted to go to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And after having studied agriculture and nutrition, I felt that if I had to go to Vietnam, I wanted to do something constructive rather than to do something militarily. So I applied to IVS. And at the same time, I had been drafted, and I had passed my physical, and I passed the written exam, and I was all ready to go. And that was also at the time when the lottery was started, and it didn't make any difference if you were black or white, rich or poor, everybody was equal in the lottery.
It was by birthdays.
Yeah. So I appealed at the local level in Newton to do IVS as an alternative to the military.
To your draft board.
Yeah. And I got rejected because I'm from a rich community.
And everyone else was buying their way out.
Right.
So they were desperate for bodies. Yeah.
I then applied at the state level And again, I got rejected. But at the national level, they allowed me, they gave me the deferment.
Yeah, I was wondering about that when I read it. A deferment?
Or
a CO status? Or I couldn't believe that someone could actually be drafted and pass a physical and escape.
Yeah. I don't remember the exact terms, but when I told them that I was with IBS, at the least at the national level, and that I was going to Vietnam for 2 years in a civilian capacity, they said, okay, we will accept that as alternative service.
And you didn't make a CO case or an appeal?
No.
Yeah. Huh. That's very unique.
Yeah, yeah. So I was lucky.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read that and I went, woof.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't remember the exact wording of it, but I know that.
But the case itself is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, most people could only do a CO on something
like
that. And would have a very difficult time. Unless they were a Quaker or something like that.
Exactly.
But. Anyway, I'm sorry to kind of interrupt but it was so curious.
Yeah.
That's one of the three questions I had for clarification. You know.
Yeah, I didn't plead a CO. I said that I would be going as a civilian for 2 years.
Yeah.
And they allowed it.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, let me backtrack a couple of things though. You mentioned the work down in Brazil with the ecumenical group. Were you at all religious? Or was
I was brought up in a Reformed Jewish household.
Okay.
And to me, religion was on the periphery. I mean, I don't consider myself in a formal sense a religious person.
Okay.
Well,
I asked that because I didn't think so until you mentioned that it was a religious. Although ecumenical,
Well, because some of the funding was coming from the actual cost of going to Brazil, the plane fare, the living expenses were coming from church groups, as well as the Rockefellers.
Well, they were very big in you know, Latin America. Humanitarian things.
But it was, I think it was just a general, you know, the 60s was a decade of extreme dissent and discovery.
Yeah.
And altruism. Mm-hmm. And this was all part, and those were the times when, you know, Cuba had been, Batista had been overthrown. You had the Alliance for Progress with Dean Rusk and Kennedy trying to overthrow the old land tenure systems in South America. I mean, if you read the preamble to the Alliance for Progress, you'd think that Che Guevara wrote it. I mean, it was written by the State Department.
Yeah.
And the idea was to overturn the old structures.
They had seen, my tense right, what happened to Bautista, and they know that others could do it.
Exactly.
And Che was making the pitch.
Right, he was in Bolivia. And
that's right, so you undercut him by adopting the program.
Exactly.
Okay, I was curious about that. And what about, You were born and raised here. Yeah. What did your parents do as far as their livelihood and their influence on you, too?
My mother was a homemaker. And I have two younger sisters. My father was a salesman. They led very regular, routine, you know, lives of, to me, you know, routine. Nothing out of the ordinary.
But your dad was the good provider according to the 50 standards, and your mother was the good homemaker.
Yeah, she was always home when we came home from school. And
my mom, too.
There was the glass of milk and the peanut butter sandwich.
Or hot chocolate,
or
if
hot
it was cold.
And my sisters were very, very conventional. Although one of my sisters ended up going to Afghanistan for 2 years in the Peace Corps because her husband was about to be drafted.
Ah.
In '68.
Uh huh.
and he had won a Rhodes Scholarship the same time that Clinton had won it, but couldn't go to England because of the war, and they ended up going to Afghanistan, and then took the scholarship afterwards.
Okay. But what about, too, what, this brings up the Peace Corps thing, because that was part of the, I mean, obviously you were affected by Kennedy.
Right.
You're even in high school, you're responding to the platform.
Yeah.
Why not Peace Corps, and why IVS, and how'd you hear about it?
Because I've been told that you could not get a deferment for the Peace Corps. I mean, I've been told locally that the Peace Corps was not, that the selective service system would not recognize the Peace Corps, at least in Newton, as an alternative.
Maybe in Newton, yeah, because I got one.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of years.
But the IVS worked in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, where the Peace Corps didn't.
Right.
And also represented an area of the world where it was in the national interest of the United States to promote certain ideas and programs that would benefit both the United States and the people that that we would be working with.
Okay.
So maybe as far as in the eyes of Selective Service, Southeast Asia was a legitimate option.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really don't have a good answer to your question.
Well, there may not be, because you know, you're maybe dead right on the money for the Newton draft board. You know, I mean, my draft board, I came from a suburb that wasn't wealthy, but it was middle class. You know, my dad and the others took the commuter train into Chicago every day, and he was an accountant and treasurer of an insurance company, and then took the train back at night, you know, that sort of stuff. And my mom was the good homemaker, you know. And so, you know, I think a lot of my high school class probably, I know, went out of college.
Yeah.
And went off into all sorts of things. Yeah. So they were a little scarce of bodies, but I still was able to get a 2A for Peace Corps for 2 years, because there was at least enough farm kids around.
Well, that's I must have gotten a 2A too for IVS.
Yeah, yeah.
That was yeah.
Yeah, but maybe they decided for Vietnam it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Peace Corps, I couldn't get it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fine. Yeah. I mean, the, a lot of the local draft boards were really just kind of winging it, you know? And most people wouldn't fight.
Yeah.
You know, so they just go or whatever.
Because I think the alternative of either going to jail or to Canada or being totally ostracized in your community is a tremendous strain. I mean, you had to go on living, and you just had to decide which battles you were going
to
fight.
You had your parents to think of and what they would be looked upon, and, you know, it's a tough decision. Yeah, I was waffling between Peace Corps and you know, the Navy and, you know, officer thing, you know, and stuff Navy, like that.
Yeah, ROTC, officers, candidates.
Yeah, candidate, you know, taking a test for that and see if I could get in, and, you know, all that as an option, you know, while still thinking, well, I don't want to go to Canada. I wonder what jail would be like. So I had those three things that was going on in my mind all at the same time, you know.
One of my best friends went off to Canada. And he went on principle because his knees were so bad that he would have flunked his physical. He would have been 4F, but he just didn't believe in the war, and he went to Canada.
Wow!
And when Jimmy Carter gave amnesty, he could have come back, but he stayed in Vancouver, and he's a writer of children's books. He's very successful.
And he's probably quite happy where he is.
Yeah.
So Canadians got themselves a good citizen.
Yeah.
But anyway, I kind of interrupted the story to catch up on a couple of those things. So you did go off to IVS. What was the training like? And who were in your group? I mean, I know from the other talk that Steve Swift was one of the members of your group.
What happened was, at the time that I was supposed to have training in the Philippines, in Los Baños, on rice farming. But I had a broken arm.
Okay.
So I couldn't go anywhere until I healed.
Yeah.
And so I missed the training. It was for rice cultivation.
Right.
So I was sent directly to intensive Vietnamese instruction in Lam Xuyen, in the Mekong Delta.
Okay.
And I was given this Vietnamese instruction by a Vietnamese who had a North Vietnamese accent. Mm-hmm. He had migrated from the North to the South.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was going to learn Vietnamese, not from the local accent and dialect, mm-hmm. but from
the Northern accent. North. That would endear you.
Yeah. And then after, I think it was 6 months, then I went to live with a family in a village,
mm-hmm.
Among the Wahao,
mm-hmm.
In the Mekong Delta. And at that point, it was sink or swim, because they didn't speak a word of English.
Yeah.
And I had to learn the Vietnamese.
Did you choose to live with a family?
Yeah.
How come?
So
many volunteers seem to have been roommates of each other or in a compound, and very few people went off and got a family.
I felt that for me to be totally effective,
mm-hmm.
And to be totally accepted, although I wouldn't be totally assimilated.
Okay.
Accepted,
different, but acceptable. And,
right, okay. Right. They would accept me more than if I was living among them rather than living with other Americans,
mm-hmm.
and just going out on a day-to-day basis to do certain activities.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, as far as an image was concerned, I would be more effective living in a village, living with a family, alone.
Yeah.
Than living with other Americans.
That's what you assume. Yeah, do you think you were right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
And I wasn't that far away from other IVS volunteers that if I wanted companionship and wanted to speak English, that I couldn't get on a ferry or a motorcycle and in a few hours be in town or, you know, be with other IVS people.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing is the activities that I got involved in required the participation of other IVS volunteers in farmers' co-ops,
mm-hmm.
getting irrigation pumps, incubators, vaccinations for water buffalo. It wasn't just a one-man operation on my part. It was coordination with other IVS volunteers.
Them a lot.
Yeah, so we saw each other a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was curious and pleased to see that you had done that. Because in the Peace Corps, it was just assumed that you would get a family.
Right.
You know, volunteers very rarely live together, especially in the province. Manila, maybe. Cebu, perhaps. You know, provinces, never. You know, and it was so much better. And I've had volunteers say, well, you know, they were so poor, I didn't want to impose on them. Well, wouldn't necessarily be an imposition, because you could be a source of income for them by paying some rent.
Mm.
You know, so but I haven't cross-examined, you know, people like that. But good move. So what about the work? Did it help you being a Cornell Aggie?
Well, Don Luce and Tom Wickham were ex-Cornell people.
Mm-hmm. I hope to see Tom too.
Yeah. Where is he in Thailand or no? Obviously, he's in Long Island or
he's
back in New York. And
I've got to get a ferry from I think it's New London down.
Well, Cornell had a long tradition in the Philippines with Los Baños.
Mm-hmm.
And IVS being an organization that had half the volunteers from third countries like the Philippines, Taiwan, Indonesia,
mm-hmm.
South Korea,
India.
Mm-hmm. Some of the Filipinos had knowledge of the Cornell Project in the Philippines.
That's right.
And some of the AID people were also Cornell grads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was a certain camaraderie and feeling of that one could help the other.
I think this is... Oh, no, it's got tape. I was just going to say, it's about to run out.
Yeah, I think that was helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's in the camaraderie, in the practical sense of...
Oh, but as far as the knowledge that I had gotten, I thought that was helpful, too.
Okay.
Because Well, you know, if you study agriculture in New York State, you know, you study apples and dairy.
Yeah.
You're in a rice culture, you're in a whole different world.
Yeah.
But I took courses in rural sociology and anthropology, and those courses were helpful.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the technical ag courses.
Not, yeah.
But the social science courses were helpful.
Yeah.
And we were all required to read a book called A Village in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
which was written by an anthropologist, and I forget his name, but
Gerald Hickey.
Gerald Hickey. Yeah.
Okay.
And I was told that if the State Department had ever read that book,
yeah, I will put this on pause.
Yeah.
I put this back on now.
Okay. This book was considered a must reading for all people that were going to work in Asia,
mm-hmm.
because many mistakes that the French had made, the U.S. had made, Japanese had made, was not understanding the dynamics of the Vietnamese villages and the families.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the pitfalls could have been avoided had people really understood Vietnam from this perspective. And Hickey was considered the one scholar on Vietnam that the United States had. And I think he was completely neglected.
I wouldn't say he's the only one, but he was one of very, very few.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all of them were neglected.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, to reiterate, Cornell did help me.
Mm-hmm.
The agriculture, I was not about to tell the Vietnamese how to grow rice. But there were techniques that the United States had as far as transplanting rice seedlings, using hybrid varieties,
mm-hmm.
getting a second crop through irrigation,
yeah.
that the Vietnamese had not adopted and represented an advantage to the South as far as getting additional rice.
Yeah.
In fact, during the war, Vietnam was a net rice exporter, even with all the bombing and the chaos.
Yeah.
And when the war was over in 75, and the Russians came in and urged the North Vietnamese to communalize the rice paddies, Vietnam became a net rice importer because it went against the entire social structure of the society.
Mm-hmm.
The rural farmers would not plant rice to feed the urban populations and create surpluses because they weren't getting a fair price for their grain.
Yeah.
They would only plant for their villages, and consequently, the Vietnamese had to go to the World Food Program in Rome to import rice. Now, it's back to allowing the Vietnamese
where it should have been.
Where it should have been.
Yeah, all the way along.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering how, because so many people did agriculture, but they weren't necessarily Aggies.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they might have been raised on a farm in
Kansas.
Or where I've just been,
yeah.
in Indiana, Ohio,
right.
And they get there and say, you can't do this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you need a tractor. You know, well, not necessarily.
You know, the Vietnamese are now teaching the rest of the world, I forget the technical name, but it's a multi-cultural, when I say culture, it's pigs, fish, and rice in the
mm-hmm.
same paddy, where you raise the pigs on stilts.
Mm-hmm.
The manure falls through and fertilizes.
Mm-hmm.
You get the rice chaff to feed the pigs,
mm-hmm.
and you can raise the fish in the paddies.
Right.
So you have animal
which
protein.
Also drops more manure for even
right.
more growth on the rice.
And that concept is being promoted because it's organic,
mm-hmm.
it's recycled,
yeah.
and it's self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
It's being promoted in a lot of other countries. So the Vietnamese, through their own experience of thousands and thousands of years, have developed technologies
mm-hmm.
or techniques that are being used in other continents.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was Vietnam or Thailand. I think were the original ones to put fish deliberately in rice paddies,
yeah.
and then that was adopted later by the Chinese. Now the Chinese say that
they did it
first, but wrong. Whoa. She wants some attention.
Yeah.
What about the folks that you were assigned to help? I mean, they're an interesting group of Vietnamese, and their composition,
right,
ideological, certainly affected your experience.
Right. They were a Buddhist sect who had a very interesting physical characteristic to identify them from all the other Vietnamese. The men were expected to have their hair grow down to their waist, and then they would tie it up in a bun, almost like a Sikh, except the Sikh, a Sikh winds his hair around in circles and then puts a turban on.
Right.
The Wahao would tie it in a little bun, almost like a donut, in the back of their head, and they'd wear a white kerchief to keep their hair in place.
Okay.
And this was a distinguishing physical characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a couple of IVS volunteers that in the days of the 60s would be called hippies that had long hair. And of course that was a tremendous turnoff to the military that were very clean shaven and
close. The American military.
American military.
Okay.
And when they came into Wahao territory, they were embraced as one of them because they had a similar physical characteristic.
Yeah, well, they had by the other folks, makes them more effective too.
So you know, I have a nephew who wears his hair just like the Wahao, and he's never, I mean, he has long hair. He ties it in a knot in the back.
Uh-huh.
He's never been out of the United States, and he has no idea about the Wahao, and he looks just like a Wahao, except he's blonde and blue eyed. He's about 6'4".
Some other physical differences.
Yeah, yeah. and then religiously, they believed they had their own prophet, separate from the mainstream Buddhists. They were very proud people. They were sedentary rural people. They weren't nomadic. They were proud of their rice culture.
Mm-hmm.
They each had altars in their homes where they would pray. And they were very anti-communist. They felt that the communists were atheistic, anti-religion.
Mm-hmm.
They believed in their prophet. They believed in their sect, and they would not cooperate with the Viet Cong or the Viet Minh. They felt the Saigon government was extremely corrupt. They didn't want to send their boys to fight in the Saigon army.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Delta is such a flat area, you can't hide in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a communist coming in to create havoc, there was no cover. You were
right.
And so the Wahao, they formed a pact with the Saigon government that they would enforce their area of the Mekong by not allowing the Viet Cong in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a quid pro quo. And on the other hand, their sons would not be drafted into the Saigon army.
Because they're patrolling locally.
Patrolling locally. And it was an accommodation that worked.
And it did work. Mm-hmm.
And I lived with them, and I felt secure 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were Viet Cong that infiltrated, and then they were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but basically, the Viet Cong left the Wahao alone. And the Cao Dai also. But I don't have a lot of information about the Cao Dai.
Except
to know that they were also a splinter group that had their own characteristics and
very characteristic. Yeah. They were really strange.
Yeah,
that's just. I mean, sort of. There are social reasons why I think why those began.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that they could keep their own land and it was part of the communal thing, so they wouldn't be absorbed by either French landowners or Chinese landowners or stuff like that. But it's the religious beliefs are just amazing.
And they worked.
Yeah, and it worked.
Yeah. They maintain their independence.
In many respects.
Yeah.
But they were open to you.
Yeah.
Why do you think?
That's a good question. Well, maybe they felt that we weren't a threat. We weren't going to be there forever. We were temporary.
Mm-hmm.
So they saw us as someone who could help get them resources in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
That they had seen IBS for over 10 years, and we were just another group coming in for 2 years.
That's right.
And we bothered to learn the language. We bothered to sit down and use chopsticks and eat rice. We bothered to have the patience to try and understand them. And we had access to technologies that they wanted to learn about in rice culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to them, it was a win-win situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You
could do them no harm.
Right. We didn't carry weapons.
Yeah. The most that you could be was someone else with a mouth to feed, but probably pay for it anyway.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah, and you didn't carry weapons.
Right. And the other thing is that nearby there was an Australian medical team. And I think even though they practiced a lot of herbal and homeopathic medicine, if they wanted us to get access to antibiotics or some kind of bandages or whatever, we had access to that, so we could do that too.
Yeah. Were there other outside groups in the area? You mentioned the Australians. Operation
Catholic
Brotherhood.
Catholic Relief Service. Yeah, there were lay personnel, American women, and Vietnamese nuns. But this was a Buddhist area, so
yeah. I was going to ask, what's going on here?
I really don't know what the feeling was between the Catholics and the Buddhists. I'm sure there was a rivalry. The Catholics in Saigon were very entrepreneurial. Tied to the French lycées, influenced by the French, and a vestige of French colonialism. So there may have been an underlying resentment by the Buddhists toward the Catholics because they held political and economic power to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I think Ziem was Catholic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know about...
And his brother was a bishop.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was that tension.
Yeah.
But the folks you lived with were ethnically Vietnamese.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Southern and from the south. They weren't, even though my teacher was originally from the north, the Waha were all native South Vietnamese.
Okay.
And the people from Catholic Relief Service, at least the Americans, I got the feeling that the Waha accepted them like IBS people. They were very unpretentious. They were very giving people. And they weren't proselytizing them. They weren't missionaries.
Okay. So they weren't a threat to the basic fundamental beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And did you socialize with some of the Catholic relief and the Australians?
In fact, I still communicate with one of the women. She lives in Michigan. She's retired. She's got some kind of debilitating disease, but we communicate by Christmas at Christmas all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I give her a call because I know her health is, is fragile.
Yeah.
And actually, when she came back from Vietnam, she helped get Vietnamese out of Vietnam that mm-hmm. couldn't leave through the orderly departure program by writing letters and,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, people that didn't have to get in a boat and hope that they were going to be picked up at sea. And she was very active in this
mm-hmm.
And befriended a lot of Vietnamese.
Yeah. Good that, yeah.
Yeah, she was an amazing woman.
Yeah. I know some people like that. I should get back in touch with them.
Just drop them a line out of the blue and they'll probably really appreciate it.
Yeah. Those were Marian nuns.
Yeah.
I ought to call Sister Blaise and say, hey, how you doing?
Yeah. She'd get a kick out of that.
Well, I hope she would, yeah. We did a few things together. Let's see if I had, okay. I exhausted some of the other questions that I had initially. Let me see, the AID connection seemed to be very good in
my
case. At least in your case.
Yeah,
it wasn't necessarily always.
No, there was a lot of.
Why was it so good in your particular case?
Well, I'm not sure, but I think in each province there was a parallel structure for AID. There was a military advisor for each province and mm-hmm. an AID rep.
Yeah.
And Anyang being the province where it was the Wahao,
mm-hmm.
it was the most Pacific province in the Delta. And the person that they had assigned there had an ambassador. He wasn't an ambassador. He wasn't the ambassador to Vietnam.
Right.
But he was a career AID person who had an equivalent rank to an ambassador. He's a highly qualified.
That high?
Yeah.
Hmm.
He's a highly qualified person. He'd worked in Burma and Thailand. I mean, he knew Asia like the palm of his hand. And he had incredible rapport with the people. And he and I just hit it off.
So it was personal with the choice and the personal between you two?
Yeah, yeah. And he liked IVS people.
Uh-huh, I mean, okay.
You know, he didn't get hung up about if somebody had long hair or, you know, was driving a motorcycle with sandals and, you know, where all the otherwise the military had to make sure they passed inspection. So he was very sympathetic to IVS people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he was trying to relive his youth vicariously through us, I don't know. But he was just a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
So it may have been a very individual type relationship where other people just didn't have that. But I did.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you still keep in contact many years later.
Yeah. We would go down and visit him in Washington
mm-hmm.
with his family.
Yeah.
And I had gone to Brazil after Vietnam with AID, and we still kept in touch while I was down there. So.
Right, yeah. Okay, so that it was more personal.
It was more personal.
And it seems like you had somebody who really understood what you were doing.
Yep.
And facilitated rather than actively, rather than begrudgingly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, because that's the...
Some AID people were like bureaucrats that resented being in Vietnam and, you know, couldn't care less. They were just paying their dues, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
But Bill Small liked being there and wanted to leave an impact
mm-hmm.
and wanted to make an impression, a positive impression.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like it wasn't. He didn't have any vindictiveness or any resentment. He just wanted to do good. He was a nice guy.
He didn't care about turf or things like that.
Yeah.
Well, that's important.
Yeah.
You know, of course, the personnel, no matter what you've got in terms of a bureaucracy, it doesn't always wash. Okay, let me see. I had something else that was kicking around in my mind. It It concerns the Tet Offensive, because you were there then.
No, the Tet Offensive was in February in 68, and I arrived in November.
Oh, 68, so 70, so you were just
after the
after everything had died down.
After everything had died down.
Okay, yeah, because I had seen 68, and I didn't know what,
yeah,
what
month you arrived. November of 68 to November of 70.
Okay. Well, then I guess you wouldn't know how much it, if at all, it had impacted your area.
No, but one of the IBS people had been killed just prior to my arriving.
Mm-hmm.
The question was, who killed him?
Yeah. This was in your area?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I forget his name. I didn't know him.
Yeah, right, right.
I don't know whether he drove over a mine or he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it was unfortunate that he had been killed. And I don't think it was accidental. I don't remember his...
Yeah, it would seem strange that it's within this area that's so...
Yeah.
Staunchly anti-communist, that roots them out as soon as they come in and kills them.
I know.
That
or it could have been that he had been out of the area, he'd gone out of the area.
Oh, that makes more sense.
And got into a very, into a more dangerous part, which is possible.
Yeah, that's much more possible, that's much more likely.
I used to spend the weekends in Cambodia. I would take a Vietnamese Navy boat up the Mekong.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there was no war going on in Cambodia at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we go up to Phnom Penh for the weekend with the Vietnamese Navy and come back.
And that was pretty far down, so the Ho Chi Minh Trail really didn't reach into
That's right.
Yeah, that would have they would have dumped off north of Saigon, or maybe just a little bit south of Saigon, but not the bigger area.
When I look back, I guess there's two things that strike me. One is that... when I was in Cambodia, I thought the Cambodians were the nicest people in the whole world. Little did I know that you could have the Khmer Rouge and the Pol Pot. I mean, it just, of course, there are layers within the Cambodian society that I couldn't penetrate because I didn't have the language capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously there were elements there that would rise to the top when the Khmer Rouge took over.
Yeah.
But you know, to me, the Cambodians were just down-to-earth, nice people. So to think of genocide and the massacres that went on, just there's no way I can comprehend it. The other thing is that coming from a society where race is the basis for so many relationships here, to know that historically the Vietnamese and Cambodians never got along, because the Cambodians were considered dark-skinned Polynesians, inferior to the Vietnamese. And even though they were neighbors, they didn't even have diplomatic relations during the war because they hated each other. And me being neutral, you know, I had no... I mean, I liked the Cambodians and I liked the Vietnamese, and I didn't feel one way or another. But I was in the middle of a situation that had historical roots, and no matter what I said or did, it wasn't going to make one side like the other. And of course, that's what happened. I mean, they ended up fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And
again.
And you just wonder how it's going to play out, you know. So I mean, as an American, we're thrust into into an environment that has these ethnic hostilities.
Mm-hmm. Ethnic and racial.
And racial.
Because they would make the distinction whether... Yeah.
We weren't going to change that. It would be like a Bosnian coming into the United States and befriending blacks and whites.
Yeah, and getting blacks and whites to...
And there's no way that they're going to bridge the gap. So that was something that I had no understanding about when I went there. Because I really hadn't studied the history of the region.
Yeah.
And only when I've come back, since I've come back and read, you know, the history that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, and then see what's happened subsequently since 75, you get a feeling for what's going on. That was not part of my training prior to going. Of course, there's just so much you can teach somebody going into another society.
Yeah, but and the training sounds like it had the accent on language as opposed to history and culture.
Yeah.
Did you get any history and culture in the training?
If I did, I don't remember.
It was so light that it didn't leave much of an impression.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mentioned, I think I remember before asking who was in your group, and there was Steve Smith. Who else was it?
Steve Swift.
I mean,
Minnick, Smith, Bob Minnick.
Okay.
But he had already been there. I mean, when
he was going for a second tour?
Yeah, I think so. He was in Canto, which was the capital of the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was like my counselor or my overseer or, you know, if you
team
had,
leader?
Team leader, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It was Bob Flores, John Amoroso, Bob Minnick, Ron Moreau, who's the Newsweek correspondent in Baghdad now. Vic Sfano, who I mentioned had the drug problem.
Yeah.
Myself. Michelle Jacob, who I think lives in England.
Oh, maybe that's why.
Yeah.
We didn't send those forms to anyone overseas.
Yeah.
So it's just
and he was
difficult.
All I remember him is he knew how to raise pigs. He went from village to village.
He was the pig man.
He was the pig man.
Yeah, Peace Corps had a pig man in the Philippines.
Yeah. Oh, that's big stuff in the Philippines.
Oh, yes, it sure is. Yuck.
They skewer them live.
Yeah.
I think that's about it. I mean, as far as the people that I remember.
Yeah. No, it's sometimes a good idea to see who are the people who came at the same time. So, what about your own, you know, part of what you said at the very beginning of side A of this tape, you slipped immediately from precise birth date rather than
a
year,
right.
Directly almost into political consciousness even as a high school student. What impact did the experiences that you had in Vietnam continue that? Specific events that you can think of that would have even increased it or continued it or whatever?
Actually, I think what
or
happened
made you
was...
made you more conservative in some senses, too, which is
Well, I went from Vietnam to Brazil directly. But I went across the whole world. I mean, I went Laos, Thailand, Burma, Nepal, India, Afghanistan. I stayed with my sister and her husband in the Peace Corps.
That's right, yeah.
Iran,
mm-hmm.
Israel, Europe.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to Portugal, I went to Brazil.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, in 1970 or 71, I basically had no financial obligations. No social obligations.
Right.
And had a Brazilian woman who was writing me while I was in Vietnam, sending me records to learn Portuguese, but I didn't have electricity.
Quite a problem.
And autograph books that had been translated into English that were basically Brazilian romance novels.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I deserved a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued my, my dating, or there's a better word, romance, and ended up deciding to marry Rosa, stay in Brazil, and I applied to work for the Food for Peace program with AID.
Okay, yeah.
Courtship was the word.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
A romantic courtship.
A courtship.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting contracted by AID to run the Food for Peace program in Recife for the northeast of Brazil. Mm-hmm. And of course, the interesting thing was that Kennedy was so paranoid about losing other South American countries
mm-hmm.
because of Cuba, that he set up a private AID group for the Northeast. In other words, Brazil was the only country in the world that had two AID missions. One AID mission was in the Northeast, and the other AID mission was in Rio for the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And it was
the special group up there for the Northeast.
It was to undercut the peasant movements
uh-huh.
and the land reform movements
uh-huh.
that were trying to basically do what the Alliance for Progress wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to flood the Northeast with surplus grains and projects, food for work projects.
Yeah, right.
Basically, to counteract these revolutionary movements. And here I am, running one of these food programs.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm married with bills, a child on the way, and part of the the counter-revolutionary movement. But here's, you know, here I am, 27.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I've got a family.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I've blocked out ideology at this point and trying to justify what I'm doing, which I don't think is detrimental. It is and it isn't. I mean, when you distribute food, it's hard to say you're a bad guy,
mm-hmm.
but you're doing it under the guise of helping people. At the same time, you've snuffed out a kind of revolutionary movement in the Northeast that supposedly would allow people to gain access to land that they have the right to get to,
mm-hmm.
that would eventually allow them to produce food, generate income, and allow the society to become more
mm-hmm.
Democratic. Anyway, I got three contracts with AID in Recife, Rio, and Brasilia. And went back to Salvador, Brazil, where my wife was from, to work for the Rockefeller Foundation. And the Rockefeller Foundation, I was strictly administrative. And they were setting up a program called Education for Development, where they wanted to upgrade the university at the master's level and get promising students that were socially conscious into master's programs in economics, agriculture, and community health,
mm-hmm.
and have them do research in the communities with poor people, bring the research back into the classroom, and discuss it, and then develop programs to mm-hmm. help solve problems. But I was an administrator. I wasn't doing anything with food nutrition. And I realized that if I stayed in administration, I'd never get back into the technical field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
So they said, if you apply for a doctorate program, we will fund you, but you have to come back and teach at the university for 3 years as an agreement.
Uh-huh.
So I went to MIT in nutrition and food science, and I did a doctorate in nutritional epidemiology.
Mm-hmm.
And came back and taught for 3 years at the university as a visiting professor.
Yeah.
And my wife was already a chemistry professor at the university with tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And I was offered the option of getting tenure, but I had never worked in the United States in my whole life.
That's right.
You know, I've been in Vietnam and Brazil.
Yeah.
And Brazil at that time had 80% inflation
Ooh.
A year. Little did I know that it would go to 3,000%.
Yeah. Well, and 80 is already pretty bad.
Yeah. It was double digit instead of triple digit.
Yeah. Well.
Or quadruple digit.
Yeah.
I decided that I was going to take a chance and come back
uh-huh.
and give it a whirl.
Yeah.
By this time I got three kids and a wife who's giving up a tenured position at a university.
Mm.
And My advisor on my thesis from MIT had guaranteed me a soft money job as a lecturer at MIT, to run a United Nations University program as a coordinator for foreign students coming on a non-degree program to the Boston area, and I would teach a course. Oh, and I would run a nutrition program that was funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to provide technical assistance for developing countries in infant and maternal nutrition. I mean, we were the clearinghouse that would send out the consultants to do the work. But I was on soft money. I didn't know how long I was going to last, and so I had to position myself for when the money ended, and this was during the Reagan administration. And at that point, I hooked up with this consulting group that I told you that sent me
right,
the Philippines.
Yeah, right.
And now I'm self-employed in a business that buys and sells ingredients in the food business, food, feed, and pharmaceuticals. But to answer your question about how did Vietnam affect me since then, here
well,
we are.
I was thinking of your experience there that would have affected your political outlook at the time.
Oh, okay.
Especially toward the American War.
Yeah.
Because you were already pretty leery about it.
Right.
Wanting to do peace work rather than cause, be part of an army.
One anecdotal comment before answering.
Oh, yeah.
My roommate at Cornell, or one of my closest friends, was Dean Rusk's son.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So when his father would come to Cornell, and of course, there would be incredible protests.
Uh-huh.
And he was totally against what his father, his father's point of view. Yeah, from Georgia. I mean, his
fact,
he just died a few months
ago. I guess he had some kind of honorary position.
At the law school.
Yeah.
In Athens.
Yeah.
I communicate with Rich Rusk once a year. But not about Vietnam. I mean, we were.
Oh no, you're friends.
Yeah. I was ambivalent politically. I mean,
despite the protests against Khrushchev
I could see a rationale for U.S. involvement. I really believe deep down inside, at least the Vietnamese that I work with, were anti-communist.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if I used my little world as a basis to look at the war, they didn't want to be dominated by the communists, because they were going to lose their autonomy, they were going to lose their religious options, or their Buddhism, and from that standpoint, to me, the program of the communists, the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, was 100% xenophobic. Was get the foreign